folks, and welcome to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. This is Aaron.
And I'm Shay.
Shay, how are you doing this week?
Well, I'm getting over a pretty ridiculous cold that has dragged out for a week and has put me behind the eight ball, but we're going to try and get through it and put out a cool episode for you guys. I think you might like it. Speaking of which, we're doing this episode today because we got an interesting email from one of our patrons, Liz from Australia, and she kind of gave us a great idea to do something different with this episode. Her message reads, quote, "Hi, Aaron and Shay. I am a small-town sheriff in your outpost here in Melbourne, Australia. I know all you Texans, and probably most Americans, know the operational distinctions between your many levels of law enforcement. When it comes to the Texas Rangers, all I know about them is what I've seen in old movies. Can you do something that explains how they differ from the rest of the police so that I will know what I'm expected to do when I transfer or when I see some old golden age story of Texas Rangers when they are all handsome and brave and have super smart horses for company and a gorgeous girl behind every bar? Thank y'all, Liz. P.S. Down here we have cattle farms larger than Texas. Thought you'd like to know." So I think that message like kind of sparked a little bit of an idea with us because we recognize that we're Texan and we know a little bit about Texas Rangers. And there's probably even some Texans that live here that don't know everything there is to know about where Texas Rangers come from and how they have become the law enforcement agency that they are today. So this week we're doing something a little fun and somewhat different from our usual episodes. We've done quite a few cases over the course of our show that deal with Texas Rangers. However, we've never actually gone into detail about this unique division of state law enforcement officers, specifically how they came into existence, what they actually do today, and how they fit into the hierarchy of local, state, national, and even international police forces. So today, I hope to answer all those questions and more on episode 48, The Texas Rangers.
When you're in Texas, look behind you, 'cause that's where the Rangers gonna be.
And that, my friends, was the notorious Chuck Norris singing the theme song of Walker, Texas Ranger, "The Eyes of the Ranger Are Upon You."
I'm so glad you were able to find a 10-second cut of that that worked.
Oh, man, I had to battle. I searched and moved it around a couple of times. I think that's the best 10-second clip for copyright reasons, so we don't get the hammer brought down on us.
Yeah, we can't afford to pay Chuck Norris.
No. And, you know, he is a ranger and the eyes are upon you. So he'll be coming for us. But anyways, at the top of the show, like we always like to do, let's knock out some sources, okay? First off, we use the Texas Standard, a article written by Lucia Benavides in 2016. We used refusingtoforget.org, which is a website that's dedicated to a interesting cultural study that we're going to talk about a little bit later in the episode that was put together in 2013. I also used the Texas Rangers Hall of Fame Museum website. They have a lot of really interesting information over there. Very comprehensive. You should go check that out or even visit the museum if you have a chance. It's in Waco, Texas. We'll also talk about that. I used a series of articles from the History Channel all about the Texas Rangers. They actually put out some really good information all about their formation up to modern times. I used an episode of a TV show called The Real West, titled simply The Texas Rangers from 1993. It's an hour-long documentary that goes into a lot of the Old West times of the Texas Rangers and is really informative. I also used an episode of the TV show called The Texas Bucket List, which if you're a Texas native and you've watched PBS here, you've probably seen an episode or two of. They kind of travel the state and show you like cool places to go in Texas. This was from season 3, episode 8 in 2014, and it was just entitled The Texas Ranger Hall of Fame. I also used the book Texas Rangers, written by Stephen L. Hardin and published in 1991. And I used a couple of short stories from the TexasRanger.org website, which is part of the Texas Rangers History Foundation. And we'll talk about that at the end of the episode. Now, of course, we have to thank Chuck Norris for singing us out of that intro with the theme of TV's Walker, Texas Ranger. And I played that clip not just because Walker, Texas Ranger was a very popular TV show back in 1993 all the way up into 2001. I didn't even realize it went that long. And also because somehow Chuck Norris agreed to sing it. Like, how did that even happen? How did they get Chuck Norris to get into a studio and sing the theme song? but because for some people around the world, Chuck Norris's depiction is all they know about one of the most powerful and dynamic law enforcement divisions in the world.
Yep, you got that big old red beard and those action jeans.
Funny enough, the Texas Ranger Hall of Fame Museum reportedly had to add an entire section to their museum that covers just the show due to the amount of international visitors asking questions about both Chuck Norris and Walker Texas Ranger before they had it. So, like, everyone was showing up from Europe going, where's Walker Texas Ranger? Why isn't he a part of the museum?
As if he was a real historical figure.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
Let's also not forget anyone else, though, because Chuck Norris isn't the only actor who's played a Texas Ranger on TV or on the big screen to help formulate what the world believes a Texas Ranger is. There have been dozens of TV shows and films that have romanticized the life and legends of the Texas Rangers, such as The Lone Ranger, Rango, True Grit, and Hell and High Water, just to name a few. Now, long before the pop culture references and karate kicking bad guys through plate glass windows, almost 200 years ago, in fact, the real story of these courageous men and women began. Way back in 1823, settlers were expanding westward into the Texas frontier and were also encountering resistance from local Native American tribes. After several deadly conflicts on the edge of the state's borders, the father of Texas himself, Stephen F. Austin, penned a letter that was disseminated around the state as an official call to arms. Quote, "I will employ 10 men to act as rangers for the common defense. The wages I will pay said men is $15 a month, payable in property if they wish." 10 men were hired to protect some 700 refugees of the Mexican War for Independence who had settled along the edge of the Texas frontier, with several white Anglo farmers also in the region. This handful of rangers quickly made a name for themselves, and somewhere around this time, a particular saying about Austin's volunteers began to gain popularity. It goes as follows, quote, "They ride like vaqueros, they track like Indians, they shoot like Tennessee boys, and they fight like the devil." Much like the Minutemen of the American Revolution, this small group of rangers could organize quickly and travel to where they were most needed, typically helping out the settlers at the edge of the frontier. Once their mission was done, though, they could disperse and return back home. About 12 years later, during the fight for state independence from Mexico, their division was formally created by the Texas representatives with the Act of the Corps of Texas Rangers. During this time, their ranks had grown from just 10 men to over 300. The creation of this group made the Rangers the oldest law enforcement agency in North America. Did you know that?
I would have guessed.
Yeah, I didn't formally know it. I guess it makes sense now when you think about it.
Yeah.
But in 1835, when Colonel William B. Travis penned the now famous call to arms to protect the Alamo from approaching Mexican forces, the only reinforcements that arrived were a company of Rangers from nearby Gonzales, Texas. As a result, they were among the fallen Texas heroes that died on March 6, 1836, when Mexican forces finally overwhelmed the Alamo's defenses. And even as Santa Anna's Mexican forces marched across the Texas territory and people began to flee to the north, Rangers would lag behind to make sure everyone was evacuated safely.
So right from the get-go, these are a group of individuals who really take their job seriously.
Yeah, and you know, what's interesting is during these early phases, they're just like normal people. You know, they don't have badges, they don't have a uniform, they don't have anything. They have a contract and some papers with them that say, hey, I'm a Texas Ranger and I can muster together a militia to help settlers.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. Well, from the 1830s all the way to the Civil War, the Texas Rangers became a highly specialized group of fighters, trackers, surveyors, and frontier lawmen. Something else important in Texas Ranger lore happened in 1836, though, and that's when George Childress, original signer of the Texas Declaration of Independence, introduced a resolution at the General Convention that year that a single star of 5 points be recognized as the emblem of the new republic. He wrote that, quote, "Every officer and soldier of the army and members of this convention and all friends of Texas be requested to wear it on their hats and on their bosoms."
Okay, so this is like the Lone Star of Texas, correct?
Yeah. So kind of at this convention where they're all figuring out how they're going to have Texas independence, they go, hey, we should make this star symbol. Everybody should wear it. And that'll be our symbol of unity.
Unity.
Yeah. Well, taking this message to heart, Texas Rangers began creating the first ever badges in the same style. These badges were actually cut from silver Mexican cinco pesos by the Rangers themselves. So basically, when you became a Ranger, you'd get one of these Mexican cinco pesos that is silver, and you would carve out of the soft metal the five-pointed star, and you would stamp in the words Texas Ranger around the circle, around the outside. And that was where they got their first badges.
Oh, interesting. What's cinco pesos?
I think it was their silver large 5 peso.
Oh, like it was worth 5 pesos? Or yeah. It was? Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's where their badge came from.
Interesting.
Today, Texas Rangers receive 2 badges when they are promoted to the Ranger service. They get the silver badge made still from the silver Mexican cinco peso coin, but also a bronze silver plated badge, which they carry in their identification case when they show people their credentials. Close to this time, the Rangers also got their first official leader, Major Robert McAlpin Williamson, a.k.a. Three-Legged Willie.
Are we going to have to put an explicit rating on this?
Why do you ask that, Aaron?
Three-Legged Willie? What are you talking about?
What do you think it means?
I'm not going to answer that question. Why don't you just tell us?
Well, I think I was wondering along the same lines as you were, so of course I had to look into this nickname, right? Well, apparently, Major Robert McAlpin Williamson was born in Georgia, and while he was there, at the age of 15, he contracted tuberculosis, arthritis, as well as polio in his right leg, which caused his right leg to permanently stiffen at an angle of 90 degrees. Therefore, instead of chopping his leg off, he got a wooden peg leg attached to his knee, and he would just kind of hobble around with that and a wooden cane, and that's where Three-Legged Willie comes from.
Okay, a little bit different, but I like it.
Right. So this Major Robert McAlpin Williamson, even with his condition, he was a very fearless rider and an active Ranger in most of the early major battles during the Rangers installment. So this guy was ferocious, like he had a real passion for the Rangers division. By all accounts, just like this great warrior that would face people on the battlefield with his disability. Now, I don't want to sugarcoat all of the Texas Rangers and these early years and paint them as just outright do-gooders and mythical heroes. There is definitely a darker side to their history. And after all, these men were in the middle of the Wild West frontier and spent much of their time and effort fighting native tribes. And later, at the end of the century, they played a key role in the removal of Mexican Americans off of their land. Through the mid-1840s, Texas Rangers would serve as mainly Indian fighters in key battles to solidify Texas's boundaries for its eventual annexation. Texas Rangers like John Coffey Jack Hayes, Ben McCullough, and remember old Bigfoot Wallace from the Halloween episode, Aaron?
I do.
These men would all become notorious Indian fighters, battle tacticians, and Texas Ranger legends. But some of the men in their ranks, like Bigfoot Wallace and several others, could be viewed as even worse, bloodthirsty murderers. And a lot of scholars agree on this. Like, there were some really bad characters among the Texas Ranger ranks back then. I mean, they were getting paid a pretty steady paycheck monthly. You pretty much got a license to kill. Nobody could really stop you, save Stephen F. Austin himself. And they kind of got into a lot of trouble when they weren't doing their job. Some of the time, they were just gambling in saloons and getting into gunfights. Now, there are a lot of really interesting stories about a lot of different people during this period. I think some of those might deserve their own episode or another episode devoted to some of those stories. But for now, we're going to stick to my TED Talk and move on. Like most Texas Rangers, these men, like Bigfoot Wallace and some of the others, they had lost friends and family to Indian raids and major battles like the Alamo, Goliad, and even San Jacinto. So you can kind of understand that their blood debts, to some degree, fueled their overall mentality in these early years, specifically when it came to conflicts with Native Americans or Mexicans. Dr. Stephen L. Hardin, author of the book Texas Rangers, spoke to the difference between these mythical versions of Texas Rangers and their real-life counterparts in his book, stating, quote, "Unlike the Hollywood version of the cowboy, who always expresses regret at the death of even the vilest villains, Texas Rangers regarded the deaths of their adversaries with cold indifference." So basically, they're honed to do their job, and they're in battles all the time.
Yeah. And to be clear, their job is to either expel or kill a lot of non-white people in the area. I mean, that's what they were tasked to do.
Yeah, and they weren't tasked to go and capture Native Americans. They were sent there to get rid of the problem, you know, stop any kind of harm that was coming to these settlers, and that was it.
Yeah, so it's definitely a seedy part of history, but I think it's important to know all of that because that's what history is. History mm-hmm. is seedy and horrible and very disturbing. And it's important to know, you know, what the Texas Ranger that we know of today, what it came from.
Yeah. And I think it's also interesting because in the beginning, the Native Americans really had a leg up on the Texas Rangers. And what I'm talking about is that when most of these fights that they would take part in were with the Comanche and the Cherokee, the Comanche and the Cherokee had been doing this kind of warfare for hundreds of years, and they were good at it. You know, they were great riders, they were great archers, they knew how to do guerrilla warfare tactics, they knew how to participate in raids. So these tribes, they were also reacting to the expansion of these Texas settlers into their territory in the Western frontier. And the way they would react to these white and Mexican settlers moving in was with brutal raids, some of which pushed far into even central Texas. During this time, Texas Rangers' main mission for decades, like you were saying, Aaron, is basically as scouts for Indian activity. They would go and they would look and see, like, okay, have Indians been around? Are there Indians near the region? Do we need to send out more scouts? And then if they actually ran across some Native Americans, they would go ahead and meet them in battle. But at first, the Native Americans had a distinct tactical advantage during these conflicts. At the time, Rangers were using muskets and slow-loading long rifles. These weapons required the Texas Rangers to dismount their horses to fire and then slowly reload before they could shoot again. All the while, the expert Comanche and Cherokee riders could fire dozens of arrows from their horses between musket volleys and even hang off the side of their horses to avoid the oncoming fire. So, what changed? The real game changer would be the eventual technological advancement of firearms. Specifically, I'm talking about the Colt Patterson 5-shot, 36-caliber revolver. Captain Jack Hayes recognized the capability of this weapon when he went to a weapons conference out east. He talked to the buyer, and he ended up purchasing a few hundred of these pistols and outfitting all of his Texas Rangers with them. So this is the moment that the frontier conflict and ultimately the image of the Texas Ranger would be changed forever. Today, the open-carried pistol is iconic with the image of a Texas Ranger, but it has its roots deep in the 1800s during these Texas Indian skirmishes. It allowed the Rangers to ride and shoot at the same time, to reload quickly, and to keep pace with the very skilled riders of the Comanche and Cherokee. Ever wonder why a Texas Ranger has his gun belt really high on his waist? We've seen some pictures of Texas Rangers, like in the Texarkana Phantom Slayer, and I wondered why his gun was really high.
I always just figured that was the way men used to wear their pants.
No, it's not. Maybe you've never thought about it too much. But instead of carrying it low on their hip like a gunfighter would, like Doc Holliday or something, the Ranger's gun is positioned high to make it easily accessible while riding a horse.
Okay, makes sense.
Because your legs are bent, so you got to have it up higher so you can get to it while you're riding.
Sure.
Just a few short years after the Colt Patterson 5-shot revolver was introduced to their ranks, the Texas Rangers quickly learned mounted combat from their enemy and began winning the fight. The Native American tribes that were fighting for their home territory were simply no match for the versatility of the Patterson revolver and the tenacity of the Texas Rangers. By the 1850s, most of the Texas Indian conflicts were over, and Native American tribes all across the Texas Territory had been pushed farther north and westward. By 1861, the Rangers were disbanded due to the Civil War, and many Rangers joined up to fight with the Confederacy. I didn't know about that. I mean, I guess it makes sense. I never even thought about what happened during the Civil War with Texas Rangers. But a lot of them went off and became big war heroes. And there's a lot of letters from Confederate commanders that talk about the Texas Rangers. And there's like good things to say about them and then a lot of bad things. Like they start a lot of trouble. They get drunk a lot. They get into gunfights. But they're hell on the battlefield. No one can compare to the way that they fight. But after the Civil War, by the 1870s, during the Reconstruction period, the Texas Rangers were eventually reinstated. Over the next 50 years, Texas Rangers took on a new role during the heyday of the Old West, one of protecting the Commonwealth from outlaws. So during this period, it's estimated that the Texas Rangers were responsible for apprehending or killing over 3,000 criminals. Some of the more well-known criminals that they apprehended were notorious outlaw John Wesley Hardin and the prolific train robber Sam Bass. Both of these guys I have plans for doing entire episodes about, so I'm going to hold off on talking about them, but they're really interesting, and honestly, there's just a ton of these type Old West cases that we're going to save and keep in our pocket for later on. So fear not, we will definitely come back and be going over some of these notorious outlaws of Texas history. By the turn of the century, the Texas Rangers would become part of yet another horrible period of Texas history. The turbulence of the Mexican Revolution from 1910 to 1920 exacerbated an already tense situation along the state's border. Over that decade, nearly a tenth of the Mexican population would perish in that war, and another tenth would flee to the United States for safety. Now, there's already a large contingency of Mexican people living in Texas and had residency. They could vote, they could pretty much do anything, they could run for office, and there's this growing larger Mexican population along the border. Well, refusingtoforget.org paints a horrific and bloody picture of how the Texas Rangers played a key role in the atrocities that followed this period. The area known as the Nueces Strip between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande River would be hit the hardest as white Anglo settlers flooded the area via the newly built railroads in search of fortune from oil and mining ventures. These white migrants began to offer top dollar for property previously owned by Mexicans and other Texans who had been established in the region. They also did not adopt the way of life that had existed there previously for about 100 years. This was a cohabitation way of life between Mexicans and other Texans. So you have these like northerners and people from Georgia, people from Mississippi moving in, trying to make money, even people from North Texas that don't know the cultural norms of the region and really push their Anglo culture and, you know, not respect the Mexican-Texas way of life that was going on there. It was basically a perfect storm for a giant racial conflict between these two groups. The results were shocking. The Texas Rangers ended up acting as the state's authority to protect the interests of the white businessmen and women and financial developments in the region. While anyone in the area who was deemed to be of Mexican descent were extremely likely to come under attack merely for living there, the sort of things that Mexican Americans and dark-complexioned Texans were subjected to during the 10-year period were things like false convictions, public hangings, murder, rape, home raids, removals of entire communities and villages, and even burning at the stake.
Jeez. And this was all stuff that the Texas Rangers were a part of.
These were carried out by both white residents and mostly overseen by Texas Rangers themselves.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was kind of a coordinated effort by the state and local government as well, because they're trying to bring in all these entrepreneurs, real estate developers, mining operations, you know, oil companies to the area to make money.
Yeah, because we're talking about, you know, towards the tail end of industrialization period. And so Texas, I'm sure, is really hoping to get money brought into the state.
And this is the 1920s. So we're right in the middle of the Texas oil boom.
Yeah. It always goes back to money somehow, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, besides the physical attacks that were done on these people and the damage to the Mexican-American residents and other dark-skinned Texans, the Texas Rangers were actually deployed to the area during elections to carry out, quote, unprecedented assaults on Mexican-American voting rights. Yeah, they would basically go to voting booths and block anyone who looked brown from going into the voting booth and pressure them, scare them, fear tactics, that kind of stuff. And I'm talking about things that were forceful, like if a fight or a riot would break out, they would just start hanging people.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is actually all surprising because this sounds like something you'd expect from the 1800s, not something that was happening in the 20th century.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of the things that they talk about as far as this goes is Mexican Jim Crow laws that were happening in Texas. This is part of like the later on Mexican-American civil rights movement. These things will be poster points on why Mexican-American rights need to be fought for.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of scholars in the Mexican-American community and a lot of Mexican-American historians know a lot of these things. But they haven't really made it out to the greater public, and they haven't really been popularized. You know, there hasn't been a movie out about these kind of things.
You know, we all had to take, what, seventh grade Texas history courses. And I mean, obviously, it's been a very long time, but I don't know if this is a period of time where people actually talk about what was going on back then.
Yeah. And in a lot of the documentaries that I watched or things that I read, they just skip over this whole section because it's not fun to remember.
Yeah.
But it should be remembered. It's important because here in a second, we're going to talk about like what comes of this. And it's really interesting. So in early 1919, State Representative Jose Tomas Canales, the only Mexican-American legislator at the time, filed a bill intended to prevent a repeat of the Rangers' actions of the previous years by dramatically restructuring their force. This bill not only addressed civil rights concerns for Mexican Americans, but also put formal regulations and standards on the books for Texas Rangers training as law enforcement officers. On the website of refusingtoforget.org, they state, quote, "The true toll of this time will never be known, though Mexican American scholars from the 1930s to present have given estimates from several hundred to 5,000 killed." So yeah, it's an area, a really big gray area that we don't know how many people were actually affected by this, but we can guess that it was a lot. And there's certainly a ton of information and details here for us, again, to do an entire episode or series on. But I think it's interesting that one of the most horrific periods of Texas history actually found a silver lining and ended up being the catalyst for the reformation of the entire Texas Rangers division. If you'd like to learn more about this period, I would highly recommend you visit that website, refusingtoforget.org, or if you're in Texas, you can actually visit the award-winning exhibit, Life and Death on the Border, 1910 to 1920, which is at the Bullock, Texas State History Museum. Though this period certainly did a lot to hurt the image of the Texas Rangers, the next few decades would become vital for forging the state law enforcement agency into the Texas Rangers that we know and love today. Two important things happened to the Rangers during the 20s and 30s. We touched on that Texas oil boom earlier, and we also did in our episode on the bank-robbing family, the Newton Gang, as well as the episode where we covered the gang of bandits dressed up as Santa Claus who botched a different bank robbery. We also discussed how that resulting influx of oil money and wealth to the state caused crime and outlaw activity to hit historic highs. Banks, trains, and even whole towns were falling prey to the money-hungry bandits and vicious outlaws that traipsed across the state. Well, by 1925, the Texas Rangers were made part of a special task force to counteract outlaw activity. They helped track and apprehend criminals like the Newtons and the aforementioned Marshall Ratliff gang, as well as even aiding in the capture of the infamous Bonnie and Clyde. No longer were they camping on the frontier with their trusty horses by their side, but rather riding in state-issued police cars and investigating organized crime networks from their desks at regional offices. It was a whole new Texas Rangers. By 1935, the Texas Rangers were reorganized into the Texas Department of Public Safety. The same year, they established their very first official crime laboratory.
That sounds very early. What were they doing in 1935 crime laboratories?
Man, I wonder. Like, just trying to figure out, like,
fingerprints?
Is this dirt or is this gunpowder? Like, I don't know. I'm not sure. But that's when they first started. So they got their first one set up in Austin. And now they have forensic crime labs all over the state. Well, over the next several decades, the Texas Rangers proved to be the state's most valuable resource for solving serious criminal investigations. Today, there are 150 Texas Rangers across the state. Every time a position opens in one of their divisions, hundreds and sometimes thousands of the most elite Texas law enforcement officers apply. So there goes our hopes of becoming a Texas Ranger.
Oh, man. You don't think that they'll let just little old me slide in?
Man, you got to get past your yellow belt first.
Okay.
Like maybe if you get that black belt and you get some action jeans, then you can take the Chuck Norris route.
Oh, I've always wanted to kick somebody through a plate glass window.
Well, you got to start doing your jump sidekicks over patrol cars.
I can do that. Kids, just give me a couple weeks.
Okay. Their uniform, Aaron. Do you know what the Texas Ranger uniform is?
Nope.
It's stipulated in their code of conduct as consisting of Western attire.
Really?
Yep.
It's literally a part of their protocol that they have to wear Western attire?
Yes. And, you know, there's kind of a normalized popular standard that most Texas Rangers adhere to. And so whenever you see one, you might recognize them for their white shirt and tie, their cowboy boots, a white cowboy hat, official Ranger belt, and that prominently displayed silver badge. But that's about it. A lot of them wear pearl snaps. A lot of them wear flannel, you know, if they're up north and it's cold. So it really just depends. I bet you there's one in the swamps of the Texas Bayou that has like swamp shorts on.
Wow, I never knew that. I mean, every time you see one on TV, they always, I mean, a real one, not just, you know, a fictional character, but a real one being interviewed. They're always wearing a cowboy hat. And I just sort of assumed that's just what they did. I didn't know that it was literally a part of their bylines.
And it is looked down upon to have a black cowboy hat as a Texas Ranger.
Really?
Because in old Western mythology, a black hat was a bad guy.
Oh.
So they always have like a white or tan hat.
I see.
Because they're a good guy.
Okay.
They still use horses to travel through tough terrain and to search rugged areas. But more often, they use helicopters, airplanes, boats, and patrol vehicles when conducting their day-to-day casework. Today, the Texas Rangers' structure remains very similar to what was outlined in that 1935 reorganization. The agency is still divided into 7 companies, 6 district companies around the state that are spread out regionally, and they letter from A to F. And then they have a headquarters company that is H that is located in Austin. So if you're a Texas Ranger, you belong to one of those companies. Their duties have seen more changes over the years, though, and new threats posed by organized crime, terrorism, and drug cartels have stretched them far beyond their original traditional roles of crime investigation and law enforcement. Their basic mission now encompasses a whole lot of things, some of which fall into general law enforcement duties and other topics that we've already talked a little bit about. And those are their, like, statewide forensic laboratories and their famous cold case unit. And if you're a true crime fan who's listened to any kind of podcasts about Texas cases, you're probably aware of those two things, right?
Right.
I did, however, find some of their lesser-known special units and mission areas that I didn't know about personally, so I'll tell you a little bit about those. First is the Interagency Investigative Assistance Mission. And I think this one's important because it goes directly back to what Liz wrote to us about. And, you know, she was asking the question about how Texas Rangers function in the greater hierarchy of law enforcement, whether that's local, state, national, or international. And all of that's pretty much encapsulated in this first mission statement. And this part basically allows the Texas Rangers to operate with any local, national, international law enforcement agency, as long as they are pursuing justice that relates to a case that has some kind of Texas connection. And I think one of the things that allows the Texas Rangers to participate in some of those cross-agency investigations like these is the fact that they are so well-respected around the world for the quality of their work. Also, in this particular mission statement, as well in their charter, there is a special provision for the Texas Rangers where they can no longer be disbanded as long as Texas is part of the Union. I thought that was interesting. Basically, they've been disbanded once before, and they wanted to set it up to where they could never be disbanded ever again.
So I have time.
Yeah, sure. Maybe at some point you can become an honorary Texas Ranger. We'll see. Well, the next one is interagency training. We know a little bit about interagency training when it refers to Texas Rangers helping local sheriff's offices and maybe like small municipalities learn how to do some more advanced specialized techniques. And we kind of talked about that in the La Kiva episode because they're so remote, they rely on the Texas Rangers to teach their sheriff's officers a lot of techniques. Well, that's part of this mission creed, and it directs the Texas Rangers to deliver specialized training to local, state, and international law enforcement agencies. And I was actually able to pin this down because I was curious about the relationship between the Texas Rangers and the FBI and how they interact with each other. Well, the Texas Rangers have taught several courses at Quantico, And one of those courses that I was actually able to dig up was on, quote, the advanced tracking techniques used when searching for criminals in difficult terrains and conditions. And I think this kind of goes hand in hand with the fact that there's this long lineage of Texas Rangers and their history that focuses on them being trackers and hunting down criminals, as well as the fact that Texas has all these interesting different environments that they have to do law enforcement in. You've got the coastal region, the piney woods, the desert, the high plains, canyons, you know, and that's some specialized knowledge that the Texas Rangers could give to the FBI agents that do work all over the country. The Texas Rangers also have a range of special operations units, some of which I found fascinating, like they have a bomb squad. They actually have one of the most capable bomb squads in the country, and one of the very few that is actually FBI certified. So it's kind of interesting how, like, the Texas Rangers will teach FBI agents one thing, and then, like, the FBI agents will also give their knowledge about bomb squad techniques and specializations to them and certify them. So it's kind of like a teaching dovetail arrangement that they have with each other.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting back and forth that they're able to kind of provide each other information in their specialties and therefore become better organizations independently.
Yeah, and of course, they obviously share a lot of intelligence back and forth with each other. And that helps a lot, too, to build these partnerships and these relationships between these two different unique organizations. They also have a series of different special units that are prepared to deal with terror attacks, hostage situations, active shooters, and other serious emergency threats all over the state, and they can still muster up like the Texas Rangers of old and get on some helicopters, maybe call up some offices around the state, and they can all get to one area really quickly to deal with a threat. So again, it mirrors their old school history with their new technology in the modern era. They have another unit that is called the Interdiction of the Protection of Children, IPC program, and this is the last one of the special units and programs that I really wanted to mention and highlight, because it's one that the Texas Rangers have just for crimes against children and child trafficking, which totally makes sense, and I recognize that's something they should have. I just never actually thought that the Texas Rangers dealt with those crimes directly. And that's it for their special programs. Obviously, they have a lot of other areas that they cover, you know, as far as the courts and being special security details for the governor and stuff like that. But if you want to learn any more about that, you can go to the Texas Rangers Hall of Fame Museum website. They have the entire mission statement, creed, and what Texas Rangers actually do on a day-to-day basis all lined out and listed there for you.
So let me ask you a very basic question. Do any other states have forces like this that are comparable to the Texas Rangers?
I think there's other state police forces, but none of them compare to the Texas Rangers as far as scope and, you know, specialization, the quality of work that they do, you know, that they're renowned for historical cases and kind of legendary in law enforcement. No, I don't think so. I think if you were going to compare them to another state police enforcement agency, I think you would have to go outside of the country to Canada and look at the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, because they operate much in the same way that the Texas Rangers do. They have very similar specializations. They can act alone. They can act in groups. They can also pair with other agencies cross borders or within their own country. So I think that would be the closest comparison, and they're badasses, honestly. If you don't know anything about the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, you need to go check it out. They're really cool.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting, because you kind of figure that the Texas Rangers are something that's unique in this country, but it is really interesting to kind of get confirmation of that this is really a very specialized force that no other states in the union have.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it goes back to how separate Texas was for a long time and how independent Texas was. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to have their own state police force that did everything for them, their own militia. It was also comparable to a private military for a state as well as a private law enforcement agency. So there's no other state in the union that really has that.
Yeah, we special.
Oh, yeah. And nobody has Chuck Norris.
And nobody has AC&C.
That's right. Okay, so to wrap this episode up, I thought we would share some unique stories from the Texas Rangers Association Foundation. And
exciting.
Yeah, and this is like a really neat foundation that takes donations. It's a nonprofit, and basically what they do is they employ editors, writers, interviewers, and storytellers to work with real Texas Rangers in an effort to document some of their life experiences, their casework, some of the legendary things that they've done over the course of their career. First up is The Case of the Deadly Milkshake, and this is written by Robert Neiman and retired Texas Ranger Captain Jim Ray. In 1997, Captain Jim Ray did a series of interviews with the Foundation about his career, and in doing so, he retold the story of this weird case involving a milkshake. Back in 1958, a doctor at the Veterans Hospital in McKinney called the Tyler Sheriff's Department to report a poisoning. Well, Captain Jim Ray was called in to take a look and help the sheriff's office investigate. He told Robert Neiman, quote, "I went up there and I talked to the doctor, and she told me that her patient, Cecil Denny, had been brought up there from a hospital in Kilgore, and that she had diagnosed his condition as being poisoned with strychnine. All of his hair had come out, and the soles of his feet were so sore that he couldn't even walk." Well, Captain Jim Ray stationed officers at Cecil Denny's hospital door so that no one could come and deliver any more potentially fatal doses of strychnine to the man. And once that was done, Cecil eventually recovered with the help of the nurses and doctors there at the hospital. Meanwhile, while Cecil is recovering, Captain Jim Ray went and did some of his own research and took a trip out to the Denny's family farm near Kilgore, Texas, and he found a fresh bag of strychnine in the barn. He deduced that 40-year-old Cecil had been poisoned by his wife, Eva, who was 65. Apparently, she was known around town for treating Cecil harshly, and there were reports from witnesses who had seen her being hateful to Cecil in public. Eva also had two other husbands that died from mysterious circumstances in the past.
Oh, we got a black widow, huh?
It seems that way. And, you know, regarding Eva, Captain Jim Ray also added, quote, "She had old, thin, red, curly hair and was ugly as sin. A man had to be drunk, you know, to stay with her."
Oh my God.
I know.
Now, I don't know if that's appropriate. Jeez.
Yeah. I mean, come on, Captain Jim Ray. Tap the brakes, man. Ray also discovered from talks with folks who knew Cecil that he had a love for strawberry milkshakes. Eva, of course, would make these milkshakes by hand for him and even brought them up to the hospital for Cecil once he got sick.
Oh, how nice of her.
I know. Isn't that nice? Well, the curious thing is that fresh strychnine is actually pink in color. And strawberry milkshakes would be the perfect thing to hide it in.
Hmm.
Well, Captain Jim Ray thought this was curious as well, and he told Robert Neiman that she would use, quote, "just enough to make him sick, but keep him alive." See, the thing was is that old Cecil would go off hunting and fishing and stay gone 2 to 3 days drinking beer with his buddies, and she would get mad at him about that. Every time he went on one of these fishing trips, he came back home, and she'd feed him some more strychnine. So that went on for a while until he ended up in the hospital, end quote.
So she was just trying to make him sick enough to where he'd miss his camping trips?
Or maybe to punish him a little bit?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. Like, maybe she wasn't trying to kill him. That was his theory, anyway. So after the investigation, Captain Jim Ray met with the DA, and they decided to bring Cecil in to sign a formal complaint and see if he would file charges on Eva. They started talking Cecil through what they had found, and when it came time for him to sign the formal complaint, Ray said, quote, "Old Cecil kind of hung his head, and he said that, well, he didn't think he would do it. He didn't want to. And that was the end of that," end quote. Apparently, poisoning wasn't enough to break Cecil's love for Eva, and he went back to her, and they lived together for 6 more months until he went on yet another fishing trip. This time, he got a little too drunk, wrecked his car into a tree, and ended up killing himself.
Whoa, are we sure that Eva didn't, like, cut his brake lines or something?
Well, that's the question. Very suspicious, right?
Yeah.
No one ever apparently looked into this, and Captain Jim Ray didn't hear about Cecil's death until later. He did point out that Eva never served any time for the poisoning and passed away a few years later after Cecil did. Captain Jim Ray suspects she was still probably making old Cecil those milkshakes, and he probably still liked them.
Wow. Hey, do you love me enough to stay with me after I poison you with strychnine infused milkshakes?
Oh, hell no. First of all, I love milkshakes, and that would be offensive enough that you poisoned a milkshake. Second of all, no, you're a poisoner. That's crazy.
Well, also, you're allergic to strawberry, so I'd have to go with, like, banana.
Yeah, I love banana milkshakes.
Are weird and like banana milkshakes. Hey, okay, good to know. Good to know. Just no reason, just thinking.
Yeah, you're going to have to find a yellow poison. I'm sure it's out there.
Hey, guys, get in touch.
Oh, God. Hey, and also, if you like banana milkshakes, let me know. They're delicious. Put a little malt in there. Oh, man. All right, so our next story is called Sic'em. As I mentioned earlier, one of the tasks the Texas Rangers perform is acting as security detail for governors. This next short story covers just that, and it's written by Robert Neiman again and Ranger Al Kular in 2009. Back in 1983, then-Governor Mark White was attending a post-election function in San Antonio. He chose to utilize the Texas Rangers for his detail on the trip, as he preferred them to his own security. Well, Ranger Al Kular was assigned to drive Governor White to his meeting that day. While driving along the predetermined route, Ranger Kular stopped at a traffic light in a bad part of town. Other rangers were following in another vehicle, but had become separated due to red lights and heavy traffic. While waiting there at the red light, Ranger Kular glanced across the street and saw two men just beating up a third man who was lying on the ground. This put Kular in quite the pickle. On the one hand, he was a decorated Texas Ranger who took an oath to uphold the law, and suppression of open acts of violence among civilians was in his official Ranger creed, no matter where he was. However, on the other hand, he was responsible for the safety of Governor White. So he stewed on this quandary for a few seconds, and then Kular looked back at the governor, who was witnessing the exact same thing, as if to ask Mark White, "What should I do?" The governor never looked at Kular. He just uttered two words, "Sic'em."
That is amazing.
Isn't that great?
So what happened?
Well,
he sicked him?
Yes, exactly. Ranger Kular exploded out of the vehicle like a bull at a rodeo, and he charged the two men. He took the first man in a hand-to-hand maneuver that left him sprawling on the concrete trying to catch his breath. Kular then ducked a punch from the second man, and he quickly overpowered him and knocked him to the ground. Ranger Kular knew the first man was likely still a threat and probably readying himself to attack the ranger from behind. But when Kular looked back, though, to his surprise, Governor Mark White was standing over the downed man with his dress boot planted firmly on his neck.
What?
Yeah, the governor himself.
Wow.
Yeah, right?
Now, I want to see a TV show based on these two.
The governor and his, like, Texas Ranger bodyguard?
Yes!
It's like a House of Cards meets Walker Texas Ranger. I love it. Well, fortunately, it wasn't long before fellow Ranger Bob Steele arrived on scene to provide backup and obviously to relieve the governor of his foothold. Steele arrested the two men and allowed Kular and the governor to continue along on their way. They made it to the speaking engagement with time to spare, of course. Texas Ranger driving, and they also got into an altercation, but they still made it early. Well, Neiman points out in the article that this was a time before cell phones, so Ranger Kular didn't actually call to check in with his supervisor and file a report until after he had dropped the governor off at his hotel. And in the lobby, he used the desk phone to call Captain Jack Dean and relay the day's events. So Captain Jack Dean was quiet during the retelling, and when Kular finished, he simply added, quote, "With the governor?" But apparently Kular was able to, like, smooth it over, and, you know, Mark White gave him a really awesome letter of recommendation and commendation from the governor's office. And after that, you know, his supervisor, Captain Dean, was cool with it. But he was also like, "Don't ever do that again." Well, that article also added a funny note at the end, quote, "At the 2006 Texas Ranger reunion at the Texas Ranger Hall of Fame Museum in Waco, former Governor White was the keynote speaker, and Captain Dean introduced him. He also included the Sic'em story remarks. No one laughed harder than former Governor Mark White." How cool is that, right?
I love it.
Yeah. Well, to wrap things up, I had a few fun facts. You want some fun facts about Texas Rangers, Aaron?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, the first woman to serve as a Texas Ranger was actually Wendy Wakeman. She became a ranger back in 1993, and 11 years later, she was named the first female lieutenant and she is now the highest ranking female ranger in the history of the Texas Rangers.
I bet she's like the coolest lady that you could ever meet.
Dude, I want to get her on the show and talk to her.
Wendy, are you out there?
Wendy, if you're listening, call in. Let's do this. Well, since their organization in 1935, 110 Rangers have died in the line of duty. And 67 of those deaths were related to gunfire. So I'm guessing a lot of those like gunfights probably happened back between 1935 and the 60s, right? Like somewhere in there. But still, a lot of Rangers have died in gunfights. In honor of the department's 180th anniversary in 2004, a Texas Ranger badge was carried into space on the Endeavour space shuttle mission by Colonel Paul Lockhart. He apparently had a large affinity for Texas Rangers, and he asked the Texas Rangers to place one of their badges on the moon. And he took it with him and put it there.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Moon Rangers.
Hey, that's the first part of Space Force, right? Well, the Texas Rangers Division has given the honoree designation to a pretty elite group. This is what you came here for, Aaron.
Oh, wait. Are you saying that somebody can become an honorary Texas Ranger?
Yeah, that's what we were talking about earlier. This is the part you need to listen to.
Shay, tell me all the details. I've got my pen and paper, taking notes.
Okay, well, let's see how you stack up to these other honorary Texas Rangers.
Probably not well, if I were to guess, but let's see.
Okay. Well, the list includes actors John Wayne and Will Rogers. Here in Fort Worth, Will Rogers is a big deal. We have Will Rogers Coliseum, where the rodeo happens and the Fort Worth Stock Show every year. So you got one of those? And you got a bunch of movies like John Wayne?
I could.
Okay. How about being president of the United States like George H.W. Bush?
I don't know if I've ever been that successful in anything in my life, but we'll see. We'll see.
Seeing as there's not been a lady president yet, hopefully there will be a woman president at some point, but I don't think you have been.
Not at this point in time, no, Shay.
But hey, in a couple of years, when you turn 35, you can start running for president. You make that dream happen, and then you can be an honorary Texas Ranger.
Okay.
I bet the ACNC posse would vote for you. All right, last but probably least is Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris is an actual honorary Texas Ranger?
Yes, of course he is. He had a whole like ceremony and everything.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Did he wear his action jeans?
Oh, we can only hope with that weird little triangular diamond strip that's elastic in the crotch area so you can do high kicks, even though he can't kick above his waist.
Hey, now I feel like we have done a lot for Texas podcasting. I feel like we're in the running.
Hey, one of the best Texas true crime podcasts out there. Why can't we be Texas Rangers?
Oh, you're putting us at the best?
One of the best, I said.
Okay.
Who could argue with that?
Tell the Texas Rangers that, man.
We're certainly not one of the worst.
Okay. We'll include that in our letter of recommendation when we recommend ourselves to become honorary Texas Rangers.
We could just get the ACNC posse to write in letters of recommendation.
You guys.
Just flood their inbox. All right. We haven't been to the Texas Ranger Museum in Waco, but after doing this episode, I feel like we really have to go. It's not that far away from us. It's just like an hour and a half away. And it seems like a really awesome new museum. It's actually been renovated and it's got a lot of new additions and stuff. But, you know, they're supposed to have a lot of really neat artifacts from the 1830s of the original Texas Rangers. And that'd be cool. We're into archaeology. Most of all, I hope that this little refresher was interesting and fun for everyone. Mainly, my real hope is that the listeners now know a little bit more about how the Texas Rangers got their start and eventually ended up as one of the most elite law enforcement agencies in the country, if not the world.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I didn't know all of that. I mean, obviously, we all know, oh, Texas Rangers, they're really cool. They're badasses. But even if you live here in Texas, you might not necessarily have known that full history and everything. So I thought it was really intriguing to get to know all of those details. And now what's exciting is whenever we have future episodes, when we have Texas Rangers, we really know why they're there, what they're doing, how they got involved, what their specialized training was that really could add to the investigation and add to the resolution of a case. That's what I really like most about this podcast is we get to learn these details and these histories and this information that otherwise we probably would have never really looked into.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you watch a little episode on, like, a true crime TV show, and there's a Texas Ranger there, and they're involved with the case, but then you never really get the details of who that person is and what they actually do, what company they're a part of, what their responsibilities are. And I think that's all that stuff's really interesting. And I like history, too. And that's fun learning about these guys that kind of looked like Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone in the beginning with muskets. And now they've got their starched white shirts flying around in helicopters and using science to solve crimes. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah, very educational. I give you an A+.
Oh, thank you, Professor Aaron.
Well, I am glad that we had a bit of a break from a lot of the horrible cases that we've done recently. But even so, we still have an amazing good news story for you to close out the episode.
Oh, excellent.
So let's do that right after this. This good news was sent in to us from our friend and the moderator of our Facebook group, Ashley.
Hey, all right. Everybody loves Ashley. She's been doing a great job moderating our Facebook group.
That's right. And this story was covered by Larry Collins of NBC5 DFW. And it's very special because it's a story from right here in Fort Worth. And it's a brand new children's playground called Dream Park. Three women, Rachel Churchill, Sandy Mesh, and Corey Watson, have been working for 6 years to develop, fundraise, and build this special playground in Trinity Park. And the reason that the park is so special is that it's designed for children of all abilities, with a special emphasis on children with special needs. So that means that every aspect of the park was built with that in mind. So the grounds have rubber surfacing so that wheelchairs and strollers can go across them easily, and everything is set up to be wheelchair accessible. Other more specific designs include swings that have hard shells and harnesses for children who need upper body support, a large stainless steel slide for children with cochlear implants or other hearing devices. Apparently, the static electricity in regular plastic slides can actually cause these devices to malfunction.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And seesaws that are built for children who use wheelchairs. They also have these little igloos around the park that can be used for children with autism or other sensory problems. If they're feeling a little overwhelmed, it's like a quiet little spot where they can hang out for a while.
Oh, cool.
So the Dream Park is a place where all children can go and play and have fun. You know, in some families, there might be several children and one child has special needs, and it's difficult to find a place where they can all go together and no one feels left out. And because of the way the park is built, it also means that any caregivers, parents, grandparents, or whoever who might have mobility issues or special needs of their own, they can also go to Dream Park and they're able to move around the park and play with their families.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah. So in total, the park is 57,000 square feet, so it's really big. It will be the largest play space in Fort Worth, and it looks really cool. There are tons of slides and monkey bars and tunnels, and lots of really cool equipment in this space, and it's like a kid's paradise. It looks really neat. There's also going to be pavilion and picnic areas for families to meet up, probably have barbecues and birthday parties and stuff like that. It's located centrally in Trinity Park, and it will officially open next month on April 15th.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and you can find out more about the park and donate at dreamparkfw.org.
That is so cool. I love that idea. That's really encompassing and inclusive. I really like it. That's really cool.
Yeah, I want to go because it looks really fun. I'll go hang out on the playground. Well, our podcast recommendation this week is a show called Hostage from the Parcast Network, and it's a really unique, fascinating show. I don't know about you, but movies and TV shows with, like, hostage negotiations are fascinating, and they're, like, some of my favorite kind of thrillers to watch, but often you're going, okay, what really would have happened in that situation, or is that really what would happen? Is that what a negotiator would say or do? Well, Hostage is all about true stories of hostage situations. It really delves into the psychology of the captors and the hostages themselves. So they talk about, you know, what are these people thinking during these high-stakes situations? How do they handle this enormously stressful situation? And they share what the negotiators themselves are going through in trying to find peaceful resolutions to these crazy situations. So it really explores that dynamic between the captor, the hostage, and the negotiator. It's super interesting.
Yeah, I just started listening to it and I checked out the Patty Hearst episode, which was one of their early episodes, and it's really interesting. I also am looking forward to listening to the John McCain episode where he was a prisoner of war and everything that he went through. I'm really excited to check that episode out too.
Oh yeah, I think that's a 2 or 3 parter that they just put out. So yeah, it's a really interesting show. It's really heart-pounding, and it's got the feeling of like a thriller that you're watching on TV, but you know it's real, and you're I think it's really educational, and it's something completely new. You know, no other shows really focus on this specific element of true crime. So
definitely, yeah, and it's very well produced. It's got an interesting soundscape that goes with it. It's also kind of done in this really interesting narrative style. So yeah, check it out.
Yeah, episodes are released every Thursday. They've been out for, I don't know, a few months now, so they have quite a few episodes, so it's a good binge. So here is the promo right now.
Some criminals use guns.
Some use explosives.
The worst criminals use hostages.
One wrong word, one wrong move, and the hostages are dead.
Hostage, the newest podcast from Parcast, tells electrifying crime stories culminating in intense life-or-death negotiations.
There's a difference between someone that is trying to obtain money or release of a prisoner versus some larger political demands.
One of three places where Muslim gunmen are holding hostages. While there never was an exact count of hostages, it was estimated that more than 100 people were being held.
The hostage takers have said that they would start killing hostages at dawn on Saturday if demands are not met.
The Iranian hostage crisis. The story of Martin and Gracia Burnham. The Hearst kidnapping. Every Thursday, we'll explore the negotiations hidden from the public eye and the complex webs of movement needed to safely extract captives.
We'll examine tactics used by the FBI's Crisis Negotiation Unit, world governments, and even hostages' parents, highlighting the techniques that saved lives and the moments where everything went tragically wrong.
Hostage premieres Thursday, October 18th, with new episodes every Thursday. Hostage is a production of Cutler Media and part of the Parcast Network. Check out Hostage wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey guys, it is time for the after show.
The after show. The place that you always want to be and that you can go once the story is over.
Okay, that was exciting. And we're going to be reading off some of our other patrons. But first, we wanted to do a couple of birthday shout outs. The first one is for Texas Ranger Lisa.
Lisa L, you're the best and we love you. Happy birthday, Lisa L.
Beautiful. And the second happy birthday goes out to patron Michelle Guess.
Yes, Michelle, you're awesome. And I can only guess what your favorite show is. It's us. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to both of you.
Yeah, and they're both Texas Rangers, which is awesome. So thank you, Lisa L. and Michelle Guess, for being amazing contributors to the show, being producers, along with the rest of our badass crew of Texas Rangers. We've gathered quite a few now, Aaron. We also have Andrew Margerison, and we have Kate Williams, Mel Thomas, and Don Maloney. So thank you all six of our really cool Texas Rangers.
And now after this episode, you guys know exactly what you have to do in the world.
Yeah,
you have to stop crime no matter where you are.
The Texas governor might, you know, pull you aside at some point and make you be his bodyguard.
You have to say yes. You have no choice. Sorry.
Yeah, I hope your forensic skills are really good.
Yep.
Get ready for that.
Meanwhile, we actually have a little, I guess, announcement, you could say. And that is we have a new call-in line that we just created. And Shay will give you the number in just a second. But basically, what we would like to do is have our Texas Rangers introduce the show. So you just call in the line and be like, hi, I'm blah, blah, blah. And this is All Crime, No Cattle, or whatever you want to say. Doesn't really matter to us. And we're going to be putting those at the very beginning of the show, so you'll be able to enter the show. I think it'll be kind of fun. So that is for the Texas Rangers for you guys to do. And for anybody else who wants to call in, maybe if you have a story or if you just have a dumb remark or you have a joke to tell, doesn't matter. And then we'll select those and we'll play them at the end of the show.
Yeah, those will fit into our new after show segment that we are kind of playing with at this point.
Yeah.
So the call-in number is actually 682-220-9972. And of course, those kind of natural charges for calling apply. If you're calling internationally, the U.S. code is the number one at the beginning. But yeah, that's how you get in touch with us. 682-220-9972.
Awesome. I'm going to call it and just do fart noises.
You've already called and left a voicemail about poop. So
that is true, guys. That was our test call. And I just sang a song about poop and fart. Oh, gosh.
Oh, you're learning too much. You're seeing the old man behind the curtain in the Wizard of Oz.
Just embarrassing ourselves right and left. Anyways, Shay, I believe that you have patrons to thank.
Yes, I do. We need to get to our wonderful deputies. They are last, but they are certainly not least. And we definitely couldn't do this show without our giant army of deputized ACNC True Crime Posse members. So first off, we've got Tina Frost.
She's chilly.
Kathy Rambo.
That is a cool name.
The Murder in My Family podcast.
Oh, Morph, hi.
Kelly Roberts. Gracie Bosch. Danielle Dole. Kristen Buford. The Murder and Such podcast.
Hey.
Marianne Connor. The Corpus Delicti podcast.
Oh, friends.
Karen Parker. Our good friend Erica from Southern Fried True Crime. Another good friend of the show, Lainey, from the True Crime Fan Club podcast. Anna Kelton, A.R. Feutzwaggle,
my favorite,
Anna Johnson, Jessica M. O'Neill, Donald Brown, Juliana Martinez, the Ohio Valley True Crime Podcast.
Oh.
And that about does it. So thank you guys for supporting the show. We just super appreciate you guys. You guys are the heart and soul of what we do. And yeah, go over to the Patreon page and check out all the stuff we've been putting out there for you. I don't know if you're keeping up with it, but we're trying to put out more stuff. We're trying to do more things. We think we might be able to do a video chat here pretty soon. Yeah, other fun stuff for patrons. We got a giveaway coming up. So yeah, check out all that stuff.
Okay, guys. Well, I really hope that you enjoyed this episode. It's a little bit different for our show and I think true crime shows in general, but we like to do something different every once in a while. Keeps things interesting. And I thought it was a very great educational podcast, Shay.
Oh, thank you.
My dear.
I enjoyed researching it. I love history and all that. And I had a fun time doing it. And you got to mix it up every now and then.
Yeah. And now I have something new to look into, which is what kind of poison can you hide in a banana malt milkshake? Yep. So I will look into that, tell you later.
Oh, also, last remark is if you haven't checked out the Mens Rea episode that just dropped for St. Patrick's Day, yours truly, Detective Shea Butter, presents a little teaser for a future case we're going to be covering on this show that has a St. Patrick's Day theme there. And, you know, Gone Cold, Southern Fried True Crime, Michael from Unresolved and the Hoax podcast did a story on there. It was a really great collaboration, very St. Patrick's Day themed. You should go check it out. Everybody did a really good job. But until next week, always remember, the crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.